Okay, thank you everyone for listening in today. I'm Douglas Bennett, Client Portfolio Manager at Fontobel's Quality Growth Boutique. And today I'm happy to introduce Ramiz Shalhat, Co-Portfolio Manager of the Quality Growth Global Equity. Ramiz has been a Portfolio Manager at Fontobel Quality Growth for the past 3.5 years. And prior to this was an analyst for over 8 years with Fontobel Quality Growth. In total, Ramiz has 20 years of investment industry experience. So good morning, Ramiz, and welcome to our Q3 Global Equities Outlook podcast.
Good morning, Doug.
Let's get on now to our discussion of global equities. Ramiz, as you are based in Hong Kong and thus close to mainland China, I'd like to start today's global equity podcast with China. Many of us have read this week that the Chinese economy is slowing faster than previously expected. What do you think of the slowdown in China, and how might this affect investments there?
Well, Doug, this slowdown in China actually began, you know, early 2018, in fact, back half of 2017, as China essentially went through this deleveraging process and started tightening credit growth into the economy. And if you take a step back, you know, credit growth to GDP has expanded significantly over 10 years, from roughly 150% back in 2008 to now close to 260, 270%. So it's not just the level of credit is at a high absolute level, but also the rate of growth has been quite substantial in a short period of time. And the government has tightened lending growth outside of the formal banking sector, which is where we saw a real explosion. So areas like wealth management products, P2P lending, for example, were two of the large areas they cracked down on. And so we've seen credit growth slow, particularly into sectors such as infrastructure and property. And consequentially, the investment growth in those sectors slowed from, you know, mid-teens levels to low single digit now, if you look at 2019. And then you have the impact of the higher tariffs on the export sector. And you've actually seen manufacturing slow quite significantly this year, from, you know, 6% growth in January to 2.5% growth in August. So what sectors is that negative for? Essentially, you know, banks, which rely on credit growth and low NPLs, and the fixed asset investment sectors that are property, infrastructure, and the export-related sectors. This is all negative for those companies that are involved in those sectors. So, you know, essentially, they're the sectors that will be negatively impacted. But I think, you know, even in a slowing Chinese macro situation, we can still find sectors and stocks within those sectors that have good structural growth. An example of which would be e-commerce. And, you know, within e-commerce, a company like Alibaba has continued to strengthen their dominance in that sector with close to 70% market share. And I think a company like that can continue to grow at attractive rates, even in a slowing macro scenario.
Well, in light of that slowdown, what do you think the Chinese government is going to do? Do you think it's going to react in some positive way to the hard line Washington has taken on trade negotiations if the Chinese economy continues to slow? And do you think that there are repercussions for U.S. firms because of this trade dispute, besides the obvious U.S. companies like Boeing or Caterpillar?
Look, firstly, on China's response to the raising of tariffs from the U.S. and the escalation, like, I think it's quite clear now that there are some thorny issues, particularly on what China is willing to concede on IP protection and forced entry into China via joint ventures. And it seems that these sticking points are not something that China is willing to make significant concessions on. So on the trade situation, it doesn't look like we're going to get some sort of landmark deal where tariffs are rolled back. And so in light of that, look, China is implementing some stimulus, both fiscal and monetary, to sustain growth at sort of still reasonable levels. And what we've seen so far is that they provided some tax relief both to individuals and corporates. They're accelerating some of the infrastructure budget that was due for 2020 into 2019 and allowing local governments to fast track some infrastructure projects. And they've also reduced reserve requirement ratios for the banks to provide more liquidity and allow them to increase credit into the economy. So, you know, they are reacting, but even despite that, I think, you know, we are going to see growth slowing. And the second question, you know, in terms of US companies and repercussions, you know, what we've seen so far is that certain companies have actually held up fairly well. And if I point to two on the consumer side, you know, Nike, its numbers have actually even marginally accelerated in the last couple of quarters to over 20% growth in China. And Starbucks is a company that where growth has actually picked up a little bit as well in China. So, you know, consumers, if they identify a brand as being, say, global, having strong brand equity, you know, then they're not going to shy away from consuming those brands, even if there is this, you know, negative geopolitical cloud re the trade war. Other companies, I think, that are more in line with potentially being impacted, what we've seen is Apple, which is you know, more high profile and more perhaps associated with being a US company. That's a company that has seen growth in China slow faster as a result of, you know, the negative headlines around trade war.
Well, let's switch gears now and look at some specific sectors. I'm thinking about one, and that is the industrial sector. And I'm just curious, you know, that's one that's known for having more cyclical growth. Do you find areas where there's more defensive growth in that sector?
Well, the first point to make about industrials is that it's a very broad sector. It covers everything from, you know, cement companies, building materials, engineering, and even information services companies all broadly get lumped into industrials. And there are more categories as well. So within industrials, you do have some more cyclical, more capital intensive sectors, and then you have more predictable, more defensive sectors. And I mentioned information services. We think it has defensive and growth characteristics. Example would be RELX, which is a conglomerate of different information services businesses. So it has the leading business in subscriptions for university and academic journals. It also has the leading database for auto insurance underwriting, as well as one of the leading database service providers for financial firms to pick up financial fraud, and also an exhibitions business. So a lot of these businesses are driven by subscription. They have very high repeat user characteristics, and they have good, you know, pricing and volume growth. So that's an industrial which has quite good defensive characteristics and growth characteristics.
Let's switch on and look now on healthcare. What areas there should an investor tend towards or avoid, do you think?
Well, I think if you look at the broad framework for what we think investors should look at, firstly, it's important for a healthcare company to have good diversification. So if it overly relies on a single drug or a single device, then you have risk of, you know, competition, you have risk of FDA risk if either a new drug is approved in that category or they don't get an approval. So having a diversified portfolio for the company itself is important. And secondly, they need to have a good pipeline of growth, and either through, you know, particularly through new product innovation, you know, which can help offset pricing declines that you see in your existing portfolio. So they need to have a good track record and a good pipeline visible to provide that sort of growth. And I think one area in healthcare that gives you those sorts of characteristics is the med tech space. So the, you know, companies like Medtronic, Becton Dickinson, Boston Scientific. And what's attractive about this sector is that, you know, the industry structure is quite attractive. So you have in any particular category like cardiovascular or diabetes, 3 to 4 players. And so it's a difficult for new companies to get into some of these sectors given the higher R&D and certification requirements.
Let's step back for a moment. I'd just like to hear your views, Ramiz, on the subject of value versus growth investing. Do you think that we're now in the period that after a long, long performance, or well over a decade, with good returns from the growth sector, that value is again coming into its own and becoming more attractive for investors?
The first thing we'd say is that what we believe is value and growth investing is tied at the hip. So essentially, you know, if you have a sustainable growth business that is trading at reasonable valuations, well, that is good value. Sometimes, you know, making that distinction isn't so clear. You know, there is overlap. But if you look at traditional value investing, where you're looking to buy a business that's potentially not that high quality of business, but trading at a discount to book, there's a couple of difficulties. Firstly, you know, if you, let's say, give an example of a business that's trading at, you know, half book, 0.5 times to book. So you're looking for it to increase the book value. And then what? You know, you will essentially have to recycle those profits into another idea. You can't compound in that business because these are essentially more likely to be cyclical or low growth businesses. And you also need a catalyst to drive that gap in valuation. And that can take a long time to come through. And what we've, you know, seen is that values had short periods of outperformance, increasingly short periods of outperformance in the last 5 years, particularly. And those periods tend to be when the market becomes very positive, that stimulus will accelerate. And I think now what we've continually seen is that the impact of stimulus has been more muted and increasingly shorter. So that's why we're seeing very short windows of outperformance for value. But, you know, coming back to the difficulty, it's hard to consistently get right, because you need to find those businesses at a discount to book, the valuation gap needs to close, and then you need to recycle that capital. You know, whereas with growth investing, if you can find a business that has sustainable, predictable growth, strong competitive advantages, strong structural drivers with good visibility, and it's trading at reasonable valuations, it's a strategy that you can continue to compound with over a number of years if you find those right businesses. The challenge with growth investing is that you have to keep observing to see whether these businesses still have those competitive advantages or whether they're being eroded at the margin. But, you know, a lot of the leading businesses continue to reinforce their competitive advantages over time. And so you can really compound in terms of return with the earnings growth of the business. And so it's a strategy that in many ways is more attractive than traditional value investing.
All right, thanks. Let's just touch on one final point, and that is, I think, one that a lot of us think about, and that is, you know, we are in a somewhat nervous, uncomfortable situation right now with a lot of potential risks out there, whether it's the higher oil price or the slowing Chinese economy, the dispute between China and the U.S. on trade, Brexit negotiations that need to end pretty soon because the U.K. is going to have to withdraw by the end of next month. What would you tell a somewhat nervous investor in global equities right now who wants to invest for the long term, but who sees and worries about some of these real risks in the shorter term?
Look, Doug, yeah, I think the macro risks have actually been there for some time. A lot of these factors have continued to develop, let's say, in the last 12 months and maybe become a little bit more acute. But these have been risks that have been there and well known. And I think that, you know, even in the face of macro risk, the best companies can continue to grow even during weak macro. And if you think about some of the secular drivers that are playing out right now, they're going to continue regardless of a slowing in terms of global growth. For example, the shift to e-commerce certainly increased in the last 10 years, but still has a long way to go. So that'll help the likes of an Alibaba and an Amazon. The shift of workloads from on-premise to cloud, you know, we're still relatively early in that whole transition. And so companies like, you know, Microsoft, SAP, Amazon's AWS business, they will all continue to get above market growth as a result of that shift, and potentially higher margin with better cash flow. And then healthcare. So an aging population, demographics is the one thing that is more predictable than anything else. And we know that healthcare demand will continue to grow, both not just in the US, but globally. And that'll help the leading medtech players continue to grow at attractive rates, Medtronic, Becton Dickinson, or even in the managed healthcare space like United Health will be a beneficiary of that theme. So these themes will continue to play out even in a slowing growth environment. Staying out of the market will mean investors can miss out on the best companies that are leveraged to those things.
All right. Well, that certainly helps me sleep a little bit better. I hope the rest of the audience as well. Listen, we're going to have to wrap up this discussion now. Ramiz, I'd like to thank you for your time and your thoughtful answers. And I'd like to thank as well our audience for listening to this podcast on global equities.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.